Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Listeners, we have been talking about creativity and the physiology of creativity. In the past few episodes, we focused on brain circuitry and brain networks, as well as whether neural feedback can improve creativity. And today we're talking with Dr. Alice Flaherty. She's a neurologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of neurology and psychiatry at the Harvard Medical School. She's written on a wide range of topics, including movement and mood disorders, teaching medical students, and also the creative drive. And it's that last topic we're going to focus on today, particularly the sort of dark side of creativity. Dr. Flaherty has authored the book, The Midnight Disease, The Drive to Write, Writer's Block, and the Creative Brain, in which she describes hypergraphia, the overwhelming urge to write. Dr. Flaherty, welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Saul.
Thanks. So I always like to start with an origin story. What led you to write The Midnight Disease?
I always was kind of a compulsive writer. People would say, oh, can I borrow your notes? You take such good notes, but I would just be writing, you know, stuff unrelated to the class. Then after I finished my residency, I had a very complicated pregnancy with twins who died at birth. And so I was kind of appropriately grieving for about 10 days. And then I had a manic episode, and it was just, like, very different. And one of the aspects of that was the writing kicked up 100-fold. And I was in my kind of frenzy, very excited, because I was like, oh, this is hypergraphia. I studied this in college. It's a phenomenon normally associated with temporal lobe epilepsy, but you can definitely see it in manic and, you know, bipolar disorders. And so the tiny scientist part of me that was still functional was like, that's so cool. And, but mostly I was writing, you know, just kind of nutty stream of consciousness, manic-y stuff. And then I had a kind of I was biking to my lab at the Charlestown Navy Yard. And I had kind of revelation, and it was very placed. I was biking past a particular part of the, bridge. And I suddenly thought, if the brain can cause hypergraphia, maybe writer's block is related. And I was like, I should write a book about that. And I had not really been interested in writing for other people until then. And I think part of the reason was that when you're mentally ill, you know, I was thinking I was going to lose my job, end up in a trailer park. And I was very anxious that people would see me as worth something. So if I could turn my symptom, which was this compulsive writing, into something that could get published, then poof, I go from mentally ill to author in, you know, 30 seconds.
And it wasn't just sort of a manic thought that you were having.
Well, it was a manic thought.
It was a manic thought. But it worked out.
It was also a thought. And, you know, the book took me like a year and a half to write. So I went through several cycles of mania and depression. It was supposed to be just this single postpartum thing. And then it kind of wasn't. And when I was depressed, I had no interest in writing. But I wouldn't actually call that writer's block. I mean, we can get to this later. But I just wasn't a writer. Yeah. And then when I was manic, I would start writing again.
So that sort of, to me, raises the question of what's the difference between sort of creative flow and compulsion, and how does that play out for you?
I mean, I think we both know that we would love to be able to make a distinction like that, and we kind of can't. I think a lot of the studies of creativity that show that creativity is good for you and it makes you healthier and happier and stuff, that's all looking at like normal people creativity when, you know, we do something in the shop and we're pleased with ourselves. A lot of the people that are super creative, it's not necessarily healthy from any point of view except their publisher or, you know, the people that are marketing their products. But
yeah, and I want to talk with you about that, you know, the tortured artist sort of persona that we have, and it sounds like has some truth to it. But I was also kind of curious, you sort of said that it was an interesting experience to you as a scientist, as a neurologist. What was it like to kind of live on both sides of the disorder?
It's hard to put into words. Like, everything in me was kind of split. I thought my moods were sort of separate from me. My mood was like a separate person in the room from me. It didn't really bother me that there was a, I mean, it did. It was awful, but it was also perfectly normal to have two different ways of looking at things at the same time. I mean, in a way, I love my job because I'm doing that too. I'm talking to people who are human beings, and I'm also thinking, he said that because his serotonin's too low or something. And so it was both awful and wonderful to be able to have several different perspectives on what was going on.
Mm. And so hypergraphy, it's not just writing a lot.
It's a question of degree, but yeah, I mean, we use the term when we think there's a particular disorder causing it, and we think that it's the temporal lobe is malfunctioning. But, you know, like somebody did a study once of people with temporal lobe epilepsy, which is kind of the classic phenomenon to cause it. And so they decided to take people who they thought, oh, these are hypergraphic, and then other people just with temporal lobe epilepsy, and they asked them, tell us about your illness, some kind of open-ended question like that. And the average hypergraphic person wrote, I think, like 7,500 words, you know, and everybody else wrote a paragraph. So.
Right. Okay. So that's how it shows itself, at least behaviorally. Yeah. What do we know about what's going on in the brain circuitry and networks? So, you know, it's a temporal lobe epilepsy, bipolar disorder. So
yeah.
What do we know about physiology?
Because it was originally described in temporal lobe epilepsy, people thought, well, it's something to do with temporal lobe changing its activity. I think it's very easy for us to think, oh, epilepsy, the brain is firing a lot there in the temporal lobe, and that makes the writing happen. But it's actually not during the seizure that people are writing, it's during the interictal period where the temporal lobe is kind of stunned. And so in some ways it's equivalent to having a temporal lobe lesion, although sort of a diffuse one. And what that does is it actually disinhibits the frontal lobes. So it's the frontal lobes that are doing it. And, you know, we think of our frontal lobes as the seat of the superego or something, where it's going to just be like this bossy, rule-bound thing. But in fact, our frontal lobe is like, that's where the action is. It's the motor cortex. It's where ideas come from. And the temporal lobe, to some extent, is the judge. It's the one that's saying, this is a good idea, this is a bad idea. It's judging speech meaning. And when it shuts down, it's a lot easier to speak because you don't care so much whether you're making sense. Mm-hmm. So you get this stream of consciousness writing.
So the temporal lobe kind of disinhibits. Well, you know, I think of the frontal lobe as kind of the conductor of the orchestra. And if, I guess, the conductor isn't working well, some instruments are going to be louder than others.
I don't know if conductor, you know, it's like, of course, it's so much more complicated. The conductor, it's like the engine in a way. And the temporal lobe is the one that's deciding, oh, you should stop doing that. So at least in my model of thinking about speech production, that's true. So when you have a frontal lobe lesion, then you have an expressive aphasia. It's very hard to speak. But that's because the temporal lobe is judging everything too much. You know, part of what's going on. So people, even when they can speak, they'll be very laconic. Like, you could just have the depression part of it and not speak. But anyway, I mean, I shouldn't push your metaphor. Conductor is fine. I would say actor, maybe.
Correcting my metaphor is actually welcome. So this is damage or something going on in the temporal lobe, but also possibly the frontal lobe as well.
Yeah. That when you look at, especially like in mood disorders, you've got different activity all over the brain. And sometimes there'll be more activity in both, like in mania, both the frontal and the temporal lobe. So how does that cancel out? And we don't know exactly what that activity is because we're just looking at like functional brain scans where all we do is see blood flow. But the studies of people with aphasia from like injuries to the frontal lobe and the temporal lobe, we feel like we can understand more with that. And aphasia from a bullet through your temporal lobe, that makes you talk a lot. You're not making any sense, but you're talking a lot and you don't know that you're not making sense.
Okay. Are there other conditions where you'll see hypergraphia?
Oh, you know, like adolescence. Recently had two girls that everybody, when you're up, like every intellectual or anyone that's got like a college education, we've been taught to process things by writing. And all my patients, when they get sick, or not all of them, But there's a very large subclass of people who start writing their autobiography or they start writing poetry. And I think you start calling it hypergraphia when the spouse is annoyed and says, that's weird. Like, I was talking about that, it's not necessarily the tortured artist, but they're torturing other people with their... But for example, like I have a patient who got compulsively musical, actually because of a medication he was taking. And we're all like, oh, that's so cool. And he wrote a symphony, you know, it was kind of a little bit boring symphony, but that was actually performed and so forth. But for his family, it was pathological. He was writing this kind of bad music. He had no interest in interacting with them. And, you know, is that the highest form of human achievement or is it pathological?
That goes, actually, in some ways, goes to the definition of what creativity is it seen as creative? Is it seen as unique? Is it seen as useful?
Yeah. The kind of simplified definition of creativity that I like is something that's both novel and useful in a certain context. And so in the social context of his family, it was totally not, it was novel, but totally not useful. In the context of, you know, the fundraisers, it was useful and a little bit novel because it was like four square music. But it's very important that the context that you're in. And so for me to use a lever to move a rock, that's really useful, but it's not novel because people have been doing that since Paleolithic times.
Right. So one thing you just said was that people would write poetry or they'll start to write memoirs. So in hypergraphia, is the writing meaningful? Is it random?
Is it both? Kind of by definition, it's meaningful, but it doesn't mean it's good. Like, for instance, there's another syndrome in the brain where people will just sort of copy letters. They'll write A-A-A-A or like echolalia and stuff. I don't think anyone would consider that hypergraphia, and that is from frontal dysfunction, not temporal. But like some of the examples of hypergraphia from the original Norman Geschwin papers were like a person who wrote down all these aphorisms that would be like, I can't remember, this isn't one of them, but it was stuff like, a man with a hat will not be without a head. And just like these sort of empty things like Hallmark card slogans and so forth. And like it gives you drive, but not talent. And so then you have somebody like Dostoevsky, who was a writer and also probably had temporal lobe epilepsy, but he was a journalist before he had epilepsy. And so he could write. And he also was, he was talented. So the two together made him Dostoevsky, plus a couple other things like being Russian. I mean, there's so much in context, right? But the thing about drive actually can lead to talent. If you write a lot, you tend to get better at it. I mean, if you're trying to do a good job, if you're not just, it's not just logorrhea. So that I don't want to minimize the importance of drive and creativity. In fact, it's probably more important than talent, or at least more important than IQ in a lot of situations. That if you do something a lot, we all know people in our profession that just work really hard, right? But if you do that and you make a lot of different things, some of them are probably going to be creative, even if it's just by statistical chance.
Yeah, I think it reminds me of the author Terry Pratchett. He said something like, dreaming about things is great, but you're always going to be beaten by the person who just works at it. And he was quite proficient.
Yeah.
Which actually leads to another question I have, which is not everybody who is proficient has this disorder. So where is that difference between creative drive and pathological compulsion? I mean, you suggested that if it's driving your family crazy, that may be pathological. But is Stephen King pathological? He is maybe in some ways,
because he got published. But if he lost his job because he was writing, then we'd feel differently about it. I think for me, I felt like it was pathological because it was very different. I mean, it was so much more intense, and I kind of couldn't stop it. So what does it mean to have a drive? But also, I had a meta desire to stop. Like, I would be writing on toilet paper in the bathroom, and I had to go back and see my patient. To my second order drives was not appropriate. And so that's why it felt like a compulsion. If I had like a completely easy lifestyle. Maybe I could do it for 8 hours a day and it wouldn't feel like a compulsion, but it was at a point where, how about, you know, I think a good analogy maybe is rumination versus problem solving. People who are ruminating on a problem, you know, why was I such a jerk at that party? If they come up with a solution, then it kind of wasn't ruminating if they're able to move on. But if they just keep thinking about it, then it's pathological. But sometimes we've all had patients who are ruminators, and then they come up with something really good in the midst of all this, you know, nightmarish.
Right. Well, it seems like it's like with a patient who has obsessive compulsive disorder, it's ego, you know, the thoughts of I'm going to drive into traffic, it's ego dystonic. You don't want to do it. And that's one of the sort of quick and dirty ways of differentiating, at least for the patient.
I think yes and no, because I think it's very, when I use the word compulsion, I'm using it in the sort of folk English sense and not in the obsessive compulsive sense, because there's a way in which it's opposite. So this is, if we think of the brain as having two different motivational systems, which is basically true even in amoebas, there's like different anatomy and different chemistry. OCD is ego dystonic in a primary sense. Like they don't want to be doing those things. So with my writing, it was ego syntonic at that first level. Like I really want, even when it was torture, I really wanted to be doing it. And it was only my super ego that was like, don't do that. You know, it was the second order desire that was ego dystonic.
Right. That's what I was beginning to also wonder about is, in sort of the question of when does it become pathological? I mean, like you were saying, if you could have spent your entire day writing without any consequences, it might not have been pathological.
Yeah.
So that's also context driven, just like creativity is to some extent.
To go back to your OCD example, though, another metaphor that I think is very powerful, partly because I'm a movement disorder doctor, is Tourette's versus OCD. So Tourette's have dopamine-driven compulsions. And when they're not, you know, causing the person physical injury, they're often ego syntonic. It's like scratching an itch. Now, I happen to be a very itchy person, and I love scratching an itch. You know, it feels great. It's a positive desire. Then when it's too intense, when you're hurting yourself because of your neck twitches or whatever, it's not positive anymore, but it's a sort of a second order thing. Now, lots of people have Tourette's and OCD at the same time, and but they can usually tell you the difference. They'll be like, no, that's a tick.
Yeah. Well, with hypergraphia, is there a dopamine involvement? I mean, dopamine's sort of the neurotransmitter du jour these days.
Yeah, I mean, I'm biased. It's my favorite molecule, but yeah, I felt very dopaminergic. I mean, it wasn't just hypergraphia. There were so many other drives that were increased, and it felt very dopaminergic. And the first time that I took Zyprexa, oh my God, it was actually a huge relief, even though, because I mean, it was also partly for the manic symptoms, but I could relax. It was like it hit the butt, it hit the spot. Now, I don't think I ever took Haldol. Like that would have been a purer effect, because obviously Zyprexa is affecting serotonin as well. But I didn't feel less frightened or anything. I felt like I didn't care as much, and it was so wonderful not to care. I mean, that was the whole thing about mania, is everything was so important. So one thing we know about dopamine is it's important for incentive salience, you know, like meaning in that sense of the word. And when things are too meaningful, it's just awful. You're constantly feeling like there's a secret message behind everything. So it's like exciting and terrible.
So is the hypergraphia, are you seeking something? Is it reward seeking, or are you trying to get away from something? Or is it
a little bit of both. That's what I mean about, like, I didn't want to be a failure. I wanted to be an author. That was the fleeing stuff. But the rest of it was reward seeking. Like, even when it was, there were days when I knew I was writing badly, and it was like I was looking for some particular adjective, and I'm like pawing through this heap of dead bodies to find the one word I was looking for. But when I found it, I was like, oh, thank God. You know, it was like more pleasure. Actually, it was pleasure rather than just relief. So it felt very rewarding in that way. But so take a good friend of mine is a scriptwriter for The Simpsons, And he said, you know, I've been a writer all my life, and I don't think I've ever had a day of pleasure from it. And I was like, oh my God, Rob, how come you do it? And he's like, well, you know, my father was an intellectual, and my brother wrote screenplays, and I wanted to do that too. So that's like a different kind of motivation.
Well, they're all sorts of motivations, as we know.
But we do also, there are studies showing that dopamine is like positive drives are more effective at producing creative behavior, partly because you do them when you don't have to, you know, like if you're doing it for negative reasons, as soon as you're famous, you get to stop.
Well, you also wrote about writer's block, which in some ways feels like the opposite.
It's like the opposite.
So how are they related?
One of the things that, like, I was obsessed with the notion of opposites back when I had, like, all this splitting going on, but opposites are things that are very similar except in one dimension, right? Black and white are opposites because they're both colors, or, you know, to some extent. They're not the opposite of, like, spinach, like, which is different in so many other ways. So writer's block and hypergraphia, for me, writer's block, you still have the desire to write and you can't. And that's why when I was depressed and I didn't care, I remember thinking it was like this beautiful revelation. Nothing had meaning. It was like, now I finally realize. It felt sort of zen, you know, even though I was psychotic. But that didn't feel like writer's block. When I was manic and got and couldn't write, that felt like writer's block. And that was the worst.
So we're not just talking about the behavior. We're talking about sort of what's behind the behavior. What's driving it? And are there other connections between writer's block and hypergraphia?
Yeah, I mean, I think so, because like usually it's writers that get writer's block, right?
Right.
So the connection, I think, in a way is, again, the parallel, this is a little bit oversimplified, but the parallel with the two different types of language problems that people get from injuries to their brain. Writer's block is like Broca's aphasia, it's a frontal lobe problem, where you can't produce the words. You can understand them. You know that you want to speak and you can't. And so people with Broca's aphasia are miserable, whereas hypergraphia is like Wernicke's aphasia, where you have a temporal lobe problem and you're talking about, it's, you know, the term, it's like politician speech. It sounds grammatical and empty, you know, and the person's saying it with a smile.
Well, so this does sort of make me think of, it sort of broaden the question of this idea of the tortured artist or the manic productivity. We sort of romanticize that to some extent, but, you know, from a neurologic perspective, what's going on? I mean, I guess I go back to what's hypergraphia, what's creative drive, and how do you separate them?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I hate, because I have like this focus on my own pathology, like most writers are not manic, they're not hypergraphic, and that right now, you know, like 100 years ago, people didn't think of bipolar as a source of creativity. Actually, back, you know, in the 1850s, people thought hysterics were creative, which is interesting when you think about how that's considered such a slur now. And you know, then there's the whole thing, there's a lot of things that can make people overstimulated and seek meaning besides bipolar disorder. I mean, how about unipolar depressives? There are writers who are unipolar depressives, and I can say, oh, well, they write when they're coming out of the depression, and that's like a relative hypomania. It's a little, you know, little mood boost. Now I'm really flogging it, right? there's lots of ways to be tortured too, besides being manic.
That is true. That writers are more likely than the general population to have bipolar disorder.
Like if you look in genres like Kay Jamison, or I think it was based on other people's research, but like poets, it's like 70% of poets are diagnosed either with bipolar disorder, or maybe that includes hypomania as well. Biographers are not so much.
Okay, so there's a difference, like you're saying, in the genre. So with you, when you were writing the Midnight Disease, I guess one of the things I'm wondering about is more in the creative flow side of things. Obviously, you had gone through this really horrendous experience. And I know that many people will write in order to help them get through experiences. Was that the case for you? I mean, what was that?
Grief. To me, grief felt so much more normal than all the mood stuff. And everyone was saying to me, oh, you know, you went through such a horrible thing. It's so natural that you feel like this. And they were kind of trying to normalize it, which I appreciated. But I felt like that was, I kept saying, this is biochemical. Like, what happened on day 10? I don't know. Some hormonal shift happened. It felt like, and I obsessed when I was like being writing. I wrote about my kid's death and everything. But I knew that even at the time that it was, that was just material that was there to be written about. And grief was very important to me, and I almost felt like it was being contaminated by all this nutty stuff. I mean, I was happy. How could I be happy when I was so sad? I could be both at once. I had like five emotions at once, and I was just like, you know, it was. But to get back to your actual question about was I processing things? I think that in some ways it was helpful as processing, and in other ways I was definitely making myself worse. Like, I would write myself into moods, and almost intentionally. I could convince myself, you know, get myself revved up by writing about something that was important to me. And I shouldn't have been.
Right. Well, that's a lot easier to see on the other side.
No, even at the, I don't know what, I don't even know what I was thinking at the time. Yeah.
Well, what does this tell us about, I mean, your experience, but not just your experience as well as what you've learned about writing and both pathological writing and non-pathological writing? What does this tell us about relationships between traumatic events, the effects those have, neurologic change, and creativity?
You know, there's this phrase that is so often quoted that necessity is the mother of invention. And I think in a lot of people with trauma, they'll see their trauma as producing their creativity. A guy whose name I forget, but he's a musician who wrote a biography about growing up in a cult, or an autobiography, and the trauma that he went through. And he said, people ask me, do you compose music because of your trauma? And he's like, no, that's something that I seized on that helped me a little, but the trauma only hurts my creativity. It just, you know, it destroyed my brother, for instance. You know, did he get creative? No. And I kind of felt like, so my trauma, and not to trivialize it, but it was a pretty small trauma, you know? This was basically a miscarriage. I knew I could have other kids. I thought, why are you so sad about these particular, you know, infants and so forth? You didn't even know them. This is not like having a two-year-old that you held in your arms. I didn't want to, like, pathologize that too much, but this set something off that was totally different. And the idea that necessity breeds... is the mother of invention. Adam Gopnik wrote a great article for the New Yorker a long time ago. It was called The Fifth Blade, where he argues the opposite. He says that it's actually luxury that breeds creativity. It's when you have the time to think and develop like five-bladed razors. You know, this is what he was seeing. It's like, this is creative, but this is like, just because we have too much money and time on our hands, we come up with all this stuff. But the reason that I think that we associate creativity and trauma is that trauma is a great way to get someone really activated and motivated, and that's what does it. And in a way, bipolar disorder was useful because I didn't have to have a trauma. I didn't have to be starving or poor or have all my limbs cut off. I was in that state of high motivation without too many distractions. I was well off, you know. I had a loving family. I could do what I wanted, and it'd be a lot harder. I mean, even take Stephen King. When he first started writing, he had a terrible job at a paper mill, I think, in Maine.
Yes.
I don't know if you'd call that trauma, but it was a lot more necessity and a lot less helpful for. He wrote despite all that. Anyway.
Well, I'd like to take a little bit pause here, and when we come back, we'll talk more about some of the clinical issues and maybe a little bit about what we've learned since you published the book.
Okay, great.
This has been Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Dr. Alice Flaherty, neurologist at the Massachusetts General Hospital and associate professor of psychiatry and neurology at Harvard Medical School. She is the author of numerous books and studies, including The Midnight Disease, a discussion about creative drive, writer's block, and hypergraphia, the compulsion to write. Find out more about her and her work in the show notes. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the Subscribe Here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us to get more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Calma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.